The views expressed in the following program are those of the writers and producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of KORC, its underwriters, or community airwaves.
Hello, Civics Cafe listeners. We are rolling through February with challenging weather, federal government chaos, and a wish for spring. This week, I saw my first crocus flowering in my neighborhood, and despite the snow, I could see the blooms starting to set on the Daphne. Additional harbingers of spring have been sighted. Turkey vultures are back in the valley, and you can buy locally raised tulips at the Winter Farmers Market at the Benton County Fairgrounds. The Farmers Market also has winter greens, locally grown citrus, and all sorts of other tasty things to eat. Let's continue to keep our eyes on all things local and pull up our chairs to discuss our city government. The City Council did not have any meetings last week, but that doesn't mean interesting things didn't happen. What's on the menu for us today? Let's have a giant serving of public education from the mayor and city council. More specifically, let's dig into the details of the recently live city webpage that compiles the records release of information that I am calling the city charter case, or the First Amendment case, and that the court has called Ellis versus City of Corvallis. To get started, I'll read you an article published in the Corvallis Advocate on February 13th. This piece is titled, City Publishes Webpage on the Ellis Matter, Discloses Costs, City Attorney's Opinion. Here we go. On Monday, officials published a webpage on the City of Corvallis website titled Records Relating to Charlynn Ellis versus City of Corvallis. It appears to offer all the evidence, correspondence, and documents associated with the matter, and it also supplies an update on estimated costs. As of February 4, 2025, the City of Corvallis has paid its attorneys $232,797.68 in relation to the Ellis versus City of Corvallis matter. Additionally, the City of Corvallis anticipates paying an insurance deductible of approximately $109,000 to cover Charlynn Ellis's attorney fees, according to the webpage. The page also offers the city attorney's interpretation of the federal court ruling. Beery, Elsner, and Hammond, LLP, is the city's contracted legal services provider, and an individual attorney is not identified. The court concluded that the influence and discussion clauses of Section 23F in the Corvallis City Charter are unconstitutional restrictions on speech under both the state and federal constitutions. The court also determined that the city's attempt to enforce the unconstitutional provisions based on Councillor Ellis's speech was retaliation for the speech. Because the court determined the clauses are unconstitutional on their face, the court did not analyze whether the provisions were unconstitutionally applied to Councillor Ellis's particular speech. The court also declined to decide whether Councillor Ellis's conduct violated the provisions in the first place. In the opinion, the court used the strictest tests for regulations of speech under both constitutions, relying on the terms by suggestion or otherwise and discuss in Charter Section 23F. Under those strictest tests, laws that target specific speech are presumptively unconstitutional. By contrast, courts apply a less rigorous free speech test for both constitutions when analyzing regulations that are not directed at speech itself, but rather focus on prohibited effects. The opinion thus does not affect charter provisions that do not directly target speech, but that prohibit the undesired effect of influencing or coercing a city manager in the making of an appointment, such as the coercion clause in the League of Oregon City's model charter. On the day Judge Ann Aiken issued her ruling, we asked Ellis's attorney, Jesse Buss, for his view of the decision, and he emailed back with an extensive response. Here is his response. In a way, you can blame climate change. This mess all started back in September 2023, when Councillor Ellis was, as usual, showing herself to be a climate champion. But, as far as what Councillor Ellis did, it's pretty innocuous stuff we're talking about here. Councillor Ellis took the lead in trying to get more city staff support for the Climate Action Advisory Board and to meet Corvallis' climate change-related goals. She discussed the matter at two public meetings and then made a motion for the city council to have the city manager get going on the hiring process for a climate program specialist. The city council had already budgeted for that work. But the now former city attorney and some members of the city council at the time confronted Councillor Ellis afterwards, accusing her of violating Section 23F of the city charter because she was trying to tell the city manager what to do, and they said she had forfeited her elected position because of it. So Councillor Ellis filed this lawsuit to fight back. because an elected official shouldn't lose their position just for doing their job. Voters elected her and the other counselors to make public policy and to direct the city manager in his job. What Judge Aiken did today is strike down most of Section 23F of the Corvallis City Charter as unconstitutional under both Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution and the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Judge Aiken also found that the city unconstitutionally retaliated against Counselor Ellis for exercising her protected First Amendment rights. The judge agreed with Counselor Ellis that the purpose of Section 23F is to combat cronyism and patronage, in other words, corruption. But Section 23F was worded way too broadly so that it prohibited totally innocent speech. That's what happened here. Counselor Ellis didn't say or do anything that was corrupt. For example, she didn't try to get the city manager to hire a family member or to award a city sewer or paving contract to a friend. No, Counselor Ellis was prosecuted under Section 23F only because she discussed the city's need to hire a climate program specialist and asked the city council to have the city manager get going on the hiring process. The city council had already decided to dedicate funding to climate work, so Counselor Ellis was just doing her job, and for doing her job, she almost lost it. Counselor Ellis was just reelected to represent Ward 5 for another term. So now that the offending portions of the city charter have been struck down as unconstitutional, the city councilors can focus on getting their work done without walking on eggshells. And they have been walking on eggshells for the past year. So now the city can move on, and the city councilors can speak their minds without fear of immediately losing their jobs. They just need to worry, as they should, about what the voters want from them. Generally speaking, today's decision is a win for freedom of expression and speech, but because Section 23F has been used to silence elected public officials, interfering with their ability to do the jobs they were elected to do, it is also a win for representative democracy. That was the email reply from lawyer Jesse Buss. The article in The Advocate concludes with this. Early on, 17 former city councilors and a past mayor and both of the city's primary news outlets reviewed the language of the charter and all the evidence in this matter. All independently concluded that Ellis's actions had, in fact, not violated the language of the city charter at all, and that the city officials should drop the matter. They did not drop it, and a little later, Ellis filed the federal lawsuit that put an end to the whole thing. So, that was me, Wendy Byrne, reading an article published in the Corvallis Advocate on February 13th. It refers to the records that the city has published on their website. If you want to find those records, it can take a little digging. Want to see them? Do this. To view the City of Corvallis webpage titled Records Relating to Charlynn Ellis versus City of Corvallis, go to www.corvallisoregon.gov. Once you're on the city's homepage, depending on the size of your screen, there are different items available for viewing. Using your desktop computer, you might see a rotating set of thumbnails, one of which is a link to these records. If you're using your smartphone or other smaller screen device, don't spend time searching the page. Instead, drop your cursor into the large box labeled Search and type in something like Ellis versus City of Corvallis, and bam, Bob's your uncle. The first item in the search results is the link to the page titled Records Relating to Charlynn Ellis versus City of Corvallis. Perhaps this is a good place for me to make the following statement. The views expressed in this program are those of the writers and producers, i.e., moi, Wendy Byrne, and do not necessarily reflect the views of KORC, its underwriters, or community airwaves. You are listening to KORC's News, Music, and Civics. I'm Wendy Byrne, and this is the Corvallis Civics Cafe. Because now I'm going to dish you up a serving of my opinion as to the items that are and are not on this list of records on the city webpage. So, the website lists documents that have already been available as public information. There is nothing new that I have found in these links. I was hoping for new or novel items, not just a regurgitated list of documents that have been available for quite some time now. Because of that, this list of documents disrespects those of us who have been following along and who have already seen these documents. Many people have come to council in person or sent letters to the city council and the local newspapers with their questions, and these questions remain unanswered by these documents. The type of documents I'd hope to see are the notes from the executive sessions on the subject, the leadership meetings on the subject, or complete case files from the special lawyers. Now that the case is settled, there is no legal value in keeping it confidential. how about releasing the communications between all these parties, Ellis, the mayor, the counselors, the city manager, the city attorneys, so that we, the people, can read them and form our own opinions? Not releasing the case files and communications to the public risks appearing like leadership is hiding something, which has been an issue throughout the length of this affair. The information about the budget impact seems oversimplified and incomplete. Many of us have asked for a more careful or nuanced accounting of the various costs associated with this case. That would include at least a mention of any increases in insurance-related costs, such as premium hikes or increases in deductibles. For example, this Tuesday at their business meeting, the council is being asked to vote on an increase in the budget that is directly related to insurance premiums. Coincidence? I wonder. And finally, I'll say this. The most interesting item currently on the city's webpage is the document titled January 9th, 2025, City Manager Memo on the Background, Information, and Context for the Council's Due Process Hearing. That memo is hiding in plain sight, and in it you can read the city manager's rationale for his actions regarding the situation. It reveals that the entire council never got to discuss whether or not Charlyn Ellis violated Section 23F, and reveals that many of the actions undertaken were decisions made by either the city manager or the city attorney and the council leadership, which to me means the city manager and city attorney were potentially acting outside of their job descriptions. The city council is supposed to make decisions about the city council. And if we had access, via this website, to more of the primary communications on this entire affair, we might be able to more accurately understand what happened. The city council is supposed to drive the bus, not the city manager and not the city attorney. What's coming up for city meetings next week? There will be no meetings on Monday due to observance of President's Day holiday. Instead, the city council will hold their business meeting on Tuesday, February 18th at the downtown fire station, second floor, at 6 p.m. This meeting might be spicy. On the agenda, the city council may elect to reopen the Cascade Crest subdivision public hearing to accept missing pieces of written testimony that were submitted for the February 3rd hearing. Those opposed to the development are concerned that city staff did not want the council to read their full submissions. On Tuesday, we should understand if the council is willing to reopen the record to accept those submissions. Then, in new business, the council will review the second quarter operating report and budget adjustments, follow the money, and then move on to discuss and decide on a resolution to approve a multiple-unit property tax exemption for the property development being proposed downtown by the Obie Company of Eugene. On Wednesday, February 19th, the League of Women Voters is sponsoring their Know Your City event. This week's focus is city infrastructure, and the guest speaker is the City of Corvallis' Director of Public Works, Jeff Blaine. This Know Your City meeting will cover information about the infrastructure needs of the city and funding needed to meet those needs. The meeting will be held in person at the Corvallis-Benton County Library main meeting room, starting at 7 p.m. on February 19th. A virtual attendance option is also available. You can find more information about this event on the web at lwvcorvallis.org. On Thursday, in lieu of their normal work session meeting, the Corvallis City Council will be attending an in-person training at the Albany City Hall. At this meeting, the Oregon Government Ethics Commission will be providing a training on Oregon public meetings law for the cities of Albany, Corvallis, Millersburg, and Philomath. This is a training only, and no decisions are expected to be made. And that's it for this week's show. My sincere thanks to the Corvallis Advocate for publishing that piece about the city website and supporting my reading of it today. The Advocate has published several other items this week about city government. And despite a recent spate of technical challenges, the reporters at the Gazette Times are working hard to bring us coverage of local news. So please support local journalism by supporting these newspapers. And if you like what you've been hearing on this show, support KORC's News, Music, and Civics with a donation via our webpage, korcfm.com/donate. This is a volunteer-operated station, and contributions like yours keep local music, civics, and news stories on the air. All contributions, no matter how small, help the station grow. If you have any comments or questions about the material I've shared, send me an email at wendy@korcfm.com. And if you have feedback for KORC's News, Music, and Civics, email us at news@korcfm.com. Until next time, this is Wendy Byrne for Civics Cafe, You can hear the show on Sundays from 1 to 2 p.m., on Mondays from 5 to 6 p.m., and on Tuesday mornings at 10 a.m. Civics Cafe re-airs after The Many Moods of Ben Vaughn.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. This program is heard Sundays from 1 to 2 p.m. and repeated Mondays from 5 to 6 p.m. here on KORC. The following is from an As I See It letter to the Gazette Times. You can find them online at gazettetimes.com. This particular one is "The Results of Charging Developers Too Much." It was written by Alexis Hammer, who earned his BA in Philosophy and Geography from Kent State University, and his JD and Master's in Community and Regional Planning from the University of Oregon. He currently serves as the Legislative and Policy Manager at the Oregon Department of Land Conservation and Development. This letter was published February 8, 2025, in the As I See It section of the Gazette Times. "My career in public service started from a commitment to combat climate change and advocate for equity. I quickly learned that climate and equity are not distinct issues, and that housing policy is one of, if not the, most effective tools for combating climate change at the local level. Only 35% of those who work in Corvallis live in Corvallis. Imagine how many fewer cars would be on the road if we had more affordable housing. Housing policy is also a central contributor to the racial wealth gap and economic inequality that can be addressed at the local level by creating more abundant, affordable, and diverse housing opportunities." Bjorn Beers wrote an As I See It called "Why I Really Resigned from the Corvallis Planning Commission," dated December 26th, in the Gazette Times As I See It. "As I read about the challenge that Bjorn Beers faced, from the steep infrastructure costs for his proposal to convert existing apartments to affordable condos, I was reminded of a systemic underlying cause: Oregon's infrastructure financing crisis. Without infrastructure, we cannot build the housing we desperately need. Without funding for infrastructure, we are stuck with a worsening status quo. First, though, we need to be clear about the problem. Cities are unable to fill the gap between infrastructure costs and revenue. Measures 5 and 50 have hamstrung local government revenue for decades. Tax revenue and fees from low-density residential development do not cover the maintenance costs of this infrastructure on its own. More recently, inflation and rising construction costs have exacerbated the gap in funding and infrastructure need. Corvallis, like almost all cities in Oregon, sits in a precarious financial position with high infrastructure costs and limited revenue. Solving the housing crisis is complex, and there are no silver bullets. However, some solutions are not a complete mystery. Economic development is the strongest tool to build up the tax base and alleviate the need for increasing fee-based infrastructure financing and system development charges, i.e., developer fees, on new development. Legalizing more housing types, as we have in response to state requirements, will also support a more robust tax base for cities. However, the economics of redevelopment will result in gradual changes, not overnight shifts, in development patterns. Adding jobs and diversifying housing are strategies that will take decades to materialize benefits on the scale that is necessary. In the shorter term, we need to consider the trade-offs of financing infrastructure and developing more housing. System development charges are assessed to cover the cost of new infrastructure needed to support new development. Corvallis City Council will soon consider the net impact of system development charges on housing production, kudos, and in doing so, should have challenging conversations about how we can lower development costs for more accessible housing. reasonable people can disagree about which infrastructure projects should be funded by home builders and which should be funded by tax and ratepayers. Some projects needed for new development, quote unquote, may actually serve the whole community in addition to the new development. These fees to fund projects that serve the whole community often kill housing proposals and the opportunity to grow the tax base. In aggregate, these unrealized projects undermine our ability to fund assets that benefit the whole community. The takeaway? If we're charging for infrastructure incorrectly, we get neither the infrastructure nor the housing. We need to have difficult conversations about these details to find opportunities to create more tailored policies that will produce housing and finance the infrastructure we need. That comes from the Gazette Times, "As I See It, the Results of Charging Developers Too Much," published February 8, 2025, written by Alexis Hammer. Alexis Hammer lives in Corvallis. He currently serves as the legislative and policy manager at the Oregon Department of Land Conservation and Development. You can find the Gazette Times online at gazettetimes.com. For KORC, News, Music, and Civics, I'm Dan Kroll.
The following is a story on the endangered Oregon chub by Freshwaters Illustrated, a nonprofit right here in Corvallis that's working to raise public awareness about the life, study, and conservation of freshwater ecosystems through immersive visual media and storytelling. This video is produced in partnership with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife and the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Departments, with special thanks to the Mackenzie River Trust, Queen Bee Apiaries, Dragonfly Ranch, and Bird Haven Farms. You can find more stories and info, including how to donate, at freshwatersillustrated.org.
You know, you can drive down a road, you can even float down a river, and you really miss these kind of habitats. Oftentimes they have, little riparian forests around them that kind of protect them from view, and they're kind of forgotten. No one kayaks down a swamp. So I think it's easy to look at one of these habitats and think, oh, it's a swamp, it's a slough, it's a bog, just some mud hole. Well, this is actually, we're in part of the river right now, and this is part of the river network. When this floods up, you would think this is part of the river. As you start getting out there and you realize that these things have such diversity to them that they support a lot of life, support a lot of diversity of life. So in sloughs and swamps, Oregon chub were one of the most abundant species in the habitats. An Oregon chub is a small floodplain minnow. They're about 2 inches long. It's the only fish that's endemic to the Willamette River Basin. Endemic meaning it's the only place that it's found.
A trap like that. Now that's mostly Oregon chub though.
A couple hundred years ago, the Willamette Valley was very different than what we see today. The river would have meandered across the floodplain. It wouldn't have had one channel, but many channels. And as it moved, and it moved naturally across the floodplain, it left behind lots of remnants. Sloughs, swamps, oxbow lakes. These are the kind of places where Oregon chub would have done really well. Jump forward to today. The valley, instead of having many channels, we now have one single channel in most places. A lot of the swamps, the sloughs, the oxbow lakes have been filled in, either for agriculture, or they've been cut off from the floodplain by roads and development. On top of that, a number of dams were built to contain high flows. Those flows, those high flow events that at one point flooded the whole valley bottom, were the kind of flows we needed to actually let the river meander and change course through the Willamette Valley. And those were the flows that were required to actually create new habitats. So the Willamette River went from being a very wild river with high floods to being tamed. And during that time period, no one really thinking about what's happening to some of these species that were obligate to these habitats, that only lived in these habitats. When researchers went out to check on Oregon chub populations, especially in the main stem river where they were dominant, all those populations were gone. Those Oregon chub populations were replaced by non-native fish species. And they started raising the alarm, saying there might be a problem here. Oregon chub were listed as endangered in 1993.
Good condition, its body's thick.
The focus on the early steps of our recovery were protecting the populations we had left. And we also started an introduction program for Oregon chub, basically backing up these populations. Anybody who's driven through the Willamette Valley knows this is an agricultural landscape. To do conservation of Oregon chub meant going into privately owned land.
Beautiful baby hive that's just about needing more space.
I'm Karen Finley.
And I'm Tad Buford. And we are the owner-operators of Queen Bee Honey Company.
Besides the bees that we have here on the farm, we run hives for both pollination and honey production all around.
As biologists by training, we see that one of the big problems with beekeeping is the simplification of the landscape. Because Oregon chub was coming into everybody's attention, they were looking for places to restore it, and this little draw right here was ideal because there were no non-native predatory species here.
Lots of fish.
They did an excellent job installing the pond.
They took care of all the details behind the scenes, and when we had control about what they did and where they did it, but we never really had a lot of effort that we had to put into it.
It was quickly finished, and then one season it started growing in, and it's just been growing ever since then.
It's beautiful, and it brings in a lot of birds as well, so it's it adds a lot of life to the place.
There are ducks on this pond all winter.
Uh-huh.
And there'll be wood ducks, little hatch-out babies we'll see down there every year.
They're beautiful little fish. I love knowing that they're in there. And I like knowing the story behind them. They're kind of connecting us with the creek, and I'm happy to know they're there.
It's been really important that we have had Oregon chub populations established remotely in some very safe areas, and numbers and genetic diversity built up and strengthened. At the same time, it's been critically important that we've been able to secure and enhance and restore some of these areas that used to be a part of the Willamette's living river system. So when the trust first acquired Green Island, it was pretty daunting to look at the restoration of nearly 1,000 acres of habitat. And the majority of the acreage was still active farmland. That transition over the last now 13 years, from trees planted in the ground to native forests growing, from a dike that had held the river at bay being removed to watching the water come back into some of those sloughs that had been waiting and just hadn't seen water for a long time. So we're getting to the point where some of those earliest trees are now 30 and 40 feet tall.
Mosquito fish. Yeah. Little bluegill.
Yeah. But if I came out here and expected to see an Oregon chub every time we ran a seine through a side channel, I'd be sorely disappointed. But we know that we're creating space for them. As more fish get into the system and disperse within the system, they act as sources for each other that fish can move back and forth. In a place like this, we'll see a handful of chub every year. And we think that, yeah, they're probably getting moved out while other ones get moved in year to year. And when they come through, it's going to be good because they're going to find places to be.
Looking good.
We are here today to announce the official final delisting of the Oregon chub. The Oregon chub is the first fish ever to be delisted from the Endangered Species Act.
After two decades of recovering Oregon chub, it was pretty exciting when we started kind of crunching the numbers and we were going through the data, realizing that we had met our recovery goals for Oregon chub. I think the Oregon chub recovery story is a great story to share and to celebrate. And we have a lot of momentum that's behind this Oregon chub kind of movement that we want to make sure is maintained. But just because Oregon chub aren't endangered anymore doesn't mean we aren't still helping them. The Endangered Species Act is oftentimes referred to like the emergency room in a hospital. But it doesn't mean that once you're able to leave the emergency room that you don't still need to have regular care. So Oregon chub aren't at the critical state that they once were. But there's still frontiers for us in the recovery of the species. There's still things that we're working towards to see that Oregon chub will persist well into the future.
See what these little guys are doing.
For us, it means another species that can survive. We can help the Oregon chub survive. It goes with our whole idea of preserving the little bit of land we have to be Willamette Valley. And these fish are part of it.
Just trying to get those little elements all put together to have a bigger effect.
And now we have chub.
Now we have chub. A little bit of time.
Hey, everybody ready?
In my short time working on the species, I've seen a major change in the way people look at their role in maintaining this ecosystem and this environment. It's not just Oregon chub. There's a lot of species that can use our help, and that a lot of us can do things to help these species out.
Here they come.
We've put a lot of building blocks in place, and we've put a lot of processes in place in these kind of upstream tributary habitats. We're starting to see some Oregon chub slowly kind of trickling down to the lower ends of these habitats. And I guess my long-term dream for the species is that when we find one out in a main stem habitat in the tributaries, that it's not a surprise.
That was a story on the endangered Oregon chub by Freshwaters Illustrated, a nonprofit right here in Corvallis that's working to raise public awareness about the life, study, and conservation of freshwater ecosystems through immersive visual media and storytelling. This video is produced in partnership with the U.S. Department and the Oregon Departments of Fish and Wildlife, with special thanks to the Mackenzie River Trust, Queen Bee Apiaries, the Dragonfly Ranch, and Birdhaven Farms. You can find more stories and info, including how to donate, at freshwatersillustrated.org. You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics at 105.9 FM or streaming globally at korcfm.com.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. The following is a segment from Democracy Now! From Friday, February 14th, 2025. For more information on national and international news, visit democracynow.org.
From New York, this is Democracy Now! The U.S. Attorney for New York and five Justice Department officials have resigned, refusing to dismiss the Justice Department's corruption charges against New York City Mayor Eric Adams. Then to the Munich Security Conference in Germany.
We'll be dealing with President Putin largely on the phone, and we ultimately expect to meet. In fact, we expect that he'll come here and I'll go there.
nichts über die Ukraine.
Nothing should be decided about Ukraine without the Ukrainians, and nothing about Europe without the Europeans. That is a given.
Vice President J.D. Vance and Secretary of State Marco Rubio are expected to meet with Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky in Munich. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A federal judge ordered the Trump administration to restore U.S. funding for foreign aid. Judge Amir Ali, a Biden appointee, said Trump's executive order set off a shockwave for aid groups that relied on the money, which had already been appropriated by Congress. Lawyers argued the blanket freeze harmed both recipients of the aid and U.S. businesses and organizations that provide it, arguing before the court, quote, businesses are shuttering, terminating employees, food is rotting, medication expiring. A group of 14 states have sued Donald Trump and Elon Musk, accusing the president of giving the world's richest man seemingly limitless and unchecked power to dismantle federal agencies, saying it's, quote, antithetical to the nation's entire constitutional structure, unquote. Earlier this week, President Trump signed an executive order to expand the power of Musk's so-called Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE. The lawsuit comes as the Trump administration fired thousands of workers, including at the Departments of Education, Energy, and Veterans Affairs, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the Office of Personnel Management, the Environmental Protection Agency, the General Services Administration, and the Small Business Administration. On Thursday, Musk said the Trump administration should, quote, delete entire agencies, unquote, from the federal government. Fired federal workers at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau took part in a protest Wednesday outside the agency's headquarters in Washington, D.C., which have been closed all week.
The CFPB gets money back from consumers who've been screwed by banks and other financial institutions. Call your congressional representatives and say that you care about the CFPB continuing to exist.
The Trump administration's continuing to attack judges who rule against President Trump's executive actions. On Thursday, Elon Musk expressed support for impeaching the judge who blocked the president's funding freeze. Meanwhile, the American Bar Association's warned the rule of law and the nation's constitutional system are under attack. The U.S. Senate confirmed Robert F. Kennedy Jr. as health secretary Thursday, handing him control of 13 federal agencies, including the CDC, FDA, and National Institutes of Health, and oversight over Medicare and Medicaid. Democrats repeatedly warned against RFK Jr.'s confirmation, citing his espousal of vaccine conspiracy theories, including one linking vaccines to autism. The only Republican to vote against Kennedy was Senator Mitch McConnell, a survivor of polio. He said, quote, I will not condone the relitigation of proven cures, unquote. Trump later attacked McConnell and cast doubt on whether he ever had polio. RFK Jr. will control nearly $2 trillion in health spending. After his confirmation, RFK Jr. said he expects major staffing cuts at federal health agencies. On the same day as Kennedy's confirmation and swearing in, Louisiana's top health official announced Louisiana will no longer promote that mass vaccination. Also Thursday, Democratic senators grilled Linda McMahon, Trump's pick to lead the Education Department, which Trump has repeatedly threatened to shut down. McMahon, the former CEO of World Wrestling Entertainment, was questioned by Connecticut Democrat Chris Murphy on Trump's order banning diversity, equity, and inclusion, DEI.
My son is in a public school. He takes a class called African American History. If you're running an African American history class, could you perhaps be in violation of this court order, of this executive order?
I'm not quite certain, and I'd like to look into it further and get back to you on that.
McMahon's hearing was interrupted by multiple protesters, including one who warned that the People with Disabilities Education Act, that's the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, is under threat. In other cabinet news, the Senate has confirmed Brooke Rollins as Agriculture Secretary, and the Senate Judiciary Committee has advanced Kash Patel's confirmation to head the FBI. Lee Zeldin, the new head of the Environmental Protection Agency, is attempting to rescind $20 billion in grants for climate and clean energy projects that have been awarded by the Biden administration. The money was set to go to the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, known as the Green Bank, and fund projects benefiting disadvantaged communities. Zeldin also canceled a $50 million grant to the Climate Justice Alliance. The Biden administration had allocated the funding to the group, but later withheld it after CJA accused Israel of committing genocide in Gaza, allowing Trump's EPA to permanently cancel the grant. The top federal prosecutor in New York, the interim U.S. attorney, and five other high-ranking Justice Department officials have resigned to protest the Trump administration's order to dismiss corruption charges against New York City Mayor Eric Adams. In a letter, the acting interim U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, Danielle Sassoon, said dropping the case against Adams would be, quote, inconsistent with my ability and duty to prosecute federal crimes without fear or favor and to advance good faith arguments before the courts, unquote. In her letter, Sassoon, who'd been appointed by Trump, went on to accuse Adams of promising to help Trump's immigration crackdown in exchange for the charges being dropped. After Sassoon refused to drop the charges, Justice Department officials moved the case to another division, leading to more resignations. Earlier Thursday, Adams met with Trump's so-called border czar, Tom Homan, to discuss plans to reopen an ICE office inside New York's Riker Island jail complex. Protesters rallied in the streets in response. This is a Nicaraguan asylum seeker.
I'm a Nicaraguan citizen. I came to this country looking for opportunity, the opportunity that was taken away from me in my country, the opportunity for freedom of speech and to work here and to be a contributing citizen. The U.S. has taken away the liberty that Nicaragua has also taken away.
The Trump-appointed U.S. attorney who resigned, Danielle Sassoon, was a Federalist Society member and a law clerk for Justice Antonin Scalia. In related news, the Trump administration has taken back $80 million that FEMA had given New York City to cover the hotel costs for asylum seekers. New York's controller, Brad Lander, accused Elon Musk of highway robbery. Earlier this week, Musk lashed out at the use of federal dollars to provide temporary shelter to asylum seekers, falsely claiming immigrants were staying in luxury hotels. Meanwhile, in Colorado, Denver's public school district has become the first in the nation to sue Trump over its policy allowing Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, to conduct raids at schools, which caused attendance to plummet. Ukraine has accused Russia of a drone attack on the Chernobyl nuclear plant. The attack sparked a fire, but Ukraine says radiation levels remain normal. This comes as Vice President J.D. Vance is meeting with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky at the Munich Security Conference today. Vance told the Wall Street Journal the U.S. could slap Moscow with sanctions and even use, quote, military tools of leverage, unquote, if Vladimir Putin does not agree to a deal guaranteeing Ukraine's long-term independence. On Thursday, Trump said Ukraine would, of course, have a role in negotiations after evading a reporter question earlier this week on whether he saw Kyiv as an equal member of possible peace talks. In more foreign policy news, Trump has proposed talks with China and Russia aimed at the nuclear stockpiles and slashing all three of the country's military budgets in half, including the U.S. President Trump announced Thursday he's moving to impose reciprocal tariffs on trading partners across the globe, including longtime U.S. allies. He made the announcement ahead of a visit from Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi at the White House. During a joint news conference with Modi Thursday, Trump said the U.S. is increasing military sales to India, including the eventual sale of F-35 fighter jets. In Sudan, witnesses say the Rapid Support Forces stormed the country's largest camp for displaced people, looting and setting fires to homes and a market. The Zamzam camp in North Darfur has been repeatedly attacked since late last year. The RSF denied the reports about 500,000 displaced people who are suffering from famine live in the camp. The latest attack forced thousands of them to flee again. Doctors Without Borders said at least seven people were killed. In the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, armed groups are subjecting children to sexual violence, including rape. That's according to UNICEF, which has warned the targeting of children by armed groups has soared to unprecedented levels. UNICEF says it's received at least 170 reports of rape involving children. One mother told UNICEF her six daughters, the youngest 12 years old, were raped by armed men while searching for food. Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum says she's considering legal action against Google if Google refuses to reverse its renaming of the Gulf of Mexico as the Gulf of America on Google Maps.
The only place where the United States can call it something different is where it exercises sovereignty, and that's 22 nautical miles from the coast, in its territory. So, Google is wrong.
Protesters in Bolivia disrupted a government conference Thursday that was discussing lithium contracts with Chinese and Russian businesses. Bolivians say the country's lithium, the largest reserves in the world, should benefit the people of Bolivia and that deals were made without legally required consultation with indigenous communities. Lithium exploitation leads to soil degradation, water shortages, and disrupts local ecosystems. Last year was the deadliest for journalists. That's according to the Committee to Protect Journalists, which reports at least 124 journalists and media workers were killed in 2024. Nearly two-thirds of them Palestinian journalists killed by Israel. The CPJ also cites the high number of journalist deaths due to conflicts in Sudan, Pakistan, and Burma, also known as Myanmar. A federal judge temporarily blocked Trump's executive order attempting to shut down nationwide access to gender-affirming care for transgender minors. The judge's order prohibits federal agencies from conditioning or withholding funding to health care providers and institutions that provide the care. Kansas's Democratic Governor Laura Kelly vetoed a proposal to ban gender-affirming care for transgender youth for the third straight year. Thus far, Kansas Republicans have failed to overrule Kelly's veto. Meanwhile, in New Hampshire, two trans high school athletes are legally challenging Trump's order banning trans girls and women from competing in school sports. The city of Worcester, Massachusetts, passed a resolution designating itself a sanctuary city for the transgender community. Here in New York, protesters are gathering at the historic Stonewall Inn today at noon after the National Park Service attempted to erase trans and queer people from its history by removing the letters T and Q from references to LGBTQ plus people from the Stonewall National Monument website. The Stonewall Rebellion was led in part by Sylvia Rivera and Marsha P. Johnson, both transgender activists of color. A Texas judge ordered New York doctor Margaret Carpenter to stop prescribing and sending abortion pills to Texas patients and fined her $100,000. The case is expected to make its way to the Supreme Court in what would be a major test to shield laws that protect abortion providers nationwide. Meanwhile, New York Governor Kathy Hochul rejected an extradition request from Louisiana's attorney general for the same doctor, citing New York shield laws. Dr. Carpenter was indicted in Louisiana for prescribing abortion pills to a patient there online. And Senator Bernie Sanders is launching a national tour to fight oligarchy, starting with stops in Omaha, Nebraska, and Iowa City next week to speak with working-class Americans who voted for Trump.
The oligarch's nightmare is that we will not allow ourselves to be divided up by race, religion, sexual orientation, or country of origin, and will together have the courage to take them on.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
That was the headlines from Democracy Now! From Friday, February 14th, 2025. For more information on national and international news, go to democracynow.org.
This is Wendy Byrne for KORC's News, Music, and Civics, with a list of city meetings for the week of February 16th through February 22nd. City of Corvallis offices will be closed on Monday, February 17th for President's Day. Offices will reopen at 8 a.m. on Tuesday, February 18th. On Tuesday, February 18th at 6 p.m., there will be a meeting of the Corvallis City Council. Everyone is welcome and encouraged to attend City Council meetings. This meeting will be held in person and virtually. See the published agenda for meeting details and participation instructions. The published agenda can be found on the city website at corvallisoregon.gov. The address for the in-person meeting is 400 Northwest Harrison Boulevard on the second floor of the downtown fire station. On Wednesday, February 19th at 5 p.m., the Justice, Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion Advisory Board will be meeting virtually. The agenda and the electronic packet of information for the meeting can be found on the city website at corvallisoregon.gov. Also on Wednesday, February 19th at 6:30 p.m., the Corvallis Planning Commission meeting will be conducted online only. The agenda and electronic packet of information for the meeting can be found online at corvallisoregon.gov. On Thursday, February 20th at 4 p.m., the City Council will be attending a public meetings law training. The Oregon Government's Ethics Commission will be providing a training on Oregon public meetings law for the City of Corvallis, City of Albany, City of Millersburg, and City of Philomath. The meeting will take place in person at the Albany City Hall, located at 333 Brattleben Street, Southwest, in Albany, Oregon. This has been Wendy Byrne for KORC's News, Music, and Civics.
Hey folks, this is Paul from the Dark Side Cinema. This is a letter I sent out concerning the future of this place. Here we go. Lainey, the co-owner of Dark Side Cinema, and I have together decided to transition out of ownership. After damn near 30 years of bringing independent, foreign, and art films to Corvallis, we need to make plans for each of our futures. Rather than shutting down the Dark Side suddenly and letting it become another downtown business lost, we are sharing our thoughts with you and seeking your constructive feedback. Let us explain. The Dark Side has never really recovered from the years of COVID. We've been muddling along, but attendance is not what it was before, and film and supply costs have shot through the roof. We've been surviving on loans, grants, and donations. The thing is, we didn't build the Dark Side to just be a zombie living off of loans, grants, and donations. We built it to be a vibrant part of the community where people come together to be entertained and have a cultural experience. Like many small businesses, we experienced a financial gully every year. Around April, attendance drops like a stone. It is extremely stressful, and this past year has been the worst since the 2007-08 disaster. Adding to the problem is that we have not had consistently good grosses, revenue before costs, since 2020. Things have been slower than they have ever been at the Dark Side. We are making sacrifices we didn't have to make before COVID. The stress from work of keeping things going has made it hard to think beyond the next day. Complicating things is that I am no longer the dynamo who can keep up with all the Dark Side balls that I have to keep in the air. Lainey has also reached her limit of limping the business numbers along in the past 5 years. We both need to step away. So the point of all of this is we're asking you, the folks who have been supporting us since the 90s, what would you like to see happen with the Dark Side as it moves into its next phase? We have a really good crew who runs things well, and I'm comfortable saying they too would like to see the Dark Side live on, but they also need to feed their families just like you or we do. We are hoping that with community input we can come up with a solution that will keep the Dark Side viable while I run off to spend my remaining days watching soap operas and dusting my ceramic cats, and Lainey can pursue her passion for powerlifting and exotic orchids. We are getting a killer deal from rent from Book Bin Bob. This cannot last, as generosity is the only reason we have not become some lame footnote in Corvallis history. Moving the Dark Side is not an option. We have looked at selling the business, but we have not seen any local interest and would rather not sell to someone outside the community who has not already committed to growing this beast. We've considered bringing in a partner, but the caveat has always been that I must stay involved, committing to a year or two of transition. My hard exit date, however, is September of 2027. The operational budget of the Dark Side does not allow us to simply pay someone else to do the technical and building maintenance that I'm doing now and have been doing for the past decades. I built the Dark Side with skills learned from a lifetime of building and fixing everything, which is not really transferable. Our search for employees has not netted anyone who is able to interact well with the public, do back-end work, and also change out a switch in the popcorn popper without burning the building down or dying. And I'll be able to do this with a, say, minimum wage-ish. As I've said, we have a great crew of workers of the dark side. It is not fair to suggest that they can fill the void that would be created when Lainey and I step down. All of them are doing so much more than we could ask. They have young families and careers, which makes working 60 hours per week impossible. This is not to mention expecting that they have the financial resources necessary to carry the dark side through the half year it runs in the red. When the political environment becomes more divided, the importance of independent bookstores, newspapers, cinemas, and radio stations becomes critical. Independent businesses are the ones providing more provocative media and are responsive to community needs. These are interesting times, no shame. And we want to do our part to contribute to the conversation, but we are up against the hard realities. So let us begin the conversation about keeping the dark side viable as a resource for information and entertainment outside of the mainstream. Email paul@darksidecinema.com with your thoughts, feelings, and threats of protest. Oh, and your ideas to keep the dark side part of the downtown landscape. Thanks for reading this, for your patronage, and for your desire to keep independent cinema in Corvallis and us sucking less into the future.
That was the voice of Paul Turner, who wrote that email, well, within the last couple of weeks, out to, it started out on your listserv just going out to your regular patrons of the Dark Side Cinema, correct?
That is correct, yes.
And this has blown up on social media, the local Corvallis Reddit page. You had also mentioned you got some response on Facebook. As far as the response that you have gotten since sending out this email to the public, what has been the response?
The response has been overwhelming and overwhelmingly positive. The thing that has been the most heartening is people telling stories. People telling stories of, well, stories they shouldn't be telling publicly of things that have happened at the Avalon and the Dark Side over the years. And the ideas are pouring in. And, you know, we put this out to get ideas. So we are now sifting through those and trying to come up with the ones that make the most sense and that are applicable to our particular situation. But the response overwhelmingly has been people want this theater, the Dark Side Cinema, to continue to exist, and they're willing to step up to help. We feel gratitude for everything that comes in, and we certainly don't want to be anything but positive for people who want to talk to us. We live in a town that is heavily academically oriented, and the mechanics and finances around an educational institution differs severely from small businesses downtown. So we're getting a lot of suggestions that are, of course, very kind, but they are not consistent with the realities that we are up against.
Yeah, it's not easy to run a small business well nowadays, especially not in Corvallis, where you have everything from high rent, just a high cost of living. We are the most rent-burdened city in this entire state, and a lot of us have boring day jobs where something fun and cool like the Dark Side Cinema may not be a sustainable career path.
Corvallis has changed a lot in the last decade, so we've been doing this for 30 years. And
you were in the ground floor times of this cinema, correct?
I built the damn thing. I mean, I built the Avalon in 97 and opened that. In 2005, we opened the Dark Side Cinema. We spent a year building it, and I did actual construction. And the town has changed substantially. I mean, I'm flying off to other parts of the country to do work to secure my retirement, because I can't do that work here. And we are only open because Bookbin Bob has given us a great deal on our rent over the years. He's been, you know, he gets it. He's an independent bookstore. We're an independent theater. We have a job to do for our community and for the future, considering the political climate. We have a voice, and we got to use it.
And aside from the new political climate, which is unexpected for some, but a number of us saw it coming, we've lived in a culture of, well, you could say monoculture and generica for quite some time. And I can see that also making it difficult in everything from people's taste in films, attention spans, people's willingness to spend an extra couple bucks as opposed to just sitting at home and streaming or staring into the phone.
Yeah, I mean, we sit at home and stream too. It's all the rage. The dark side is viciously non-political. I mean, the closest thing to politics we have is we have a pride flag in our auditorium, or excuse me, in our snack bar in our front window. But we stay the heck out.
Human rights, the horror.
Yeah, well, human rights, that's not political. That's rights, period.
A lot of things have become political, everything from the environment to human rights.
All of that, and exactly right. So we have found at the dark side over the years that remaining politically neutral means we are not isolating the people who might be more receptive to a message that they're not familiar with. At the Avalon, I ran Bowling for Columbine, and the deal I made is if you came in with your voter registration card and you were a Republican, you got in for free. And we had people take us up on that. And what was fun is the people who come up to the snack bar afterwards and they would pay me and they would say, I came here for entertainment. That was funny. And there would be conversations. And we'd have these conversations that rolled on and on about guns in America and all of this. And that's the stuff we get to do here. That's our politics, period. We get to do this. We get to run Fog of War, and then we get to run movies that are not comfortable for the majority of Corvallis people, because that's our job, is to piss people off and to have them think.
What was the last provocative film you ran that may have gone against the Corvallis grain?
So, Moonlight. One Best Picture in
2018, I believe.
And that is the voice of Joey, the manager here at Dark Side Cinema. Yes. Also, if you listen to AM Ambient, every morning from 6 to 8, we occasionally play some of his music under the name of Theo B. Vias.
That is correct.
We are at the Dark Side Cinema. We're speaking with owner Paul Turner, and we're joined by 19-year manager Joey Bauer. Paul, when would you say was probably the most busy time for the Dark Side Cinema, when you had patronage and things just felt the most alive?
That would have been about 2019, before COVID came in and devastated the economy. We had great films. We had a lot of attendance. Everything was going well. The economy was in such a state that our overhead had reduced substantially. And then COVID, and we shut down for 15 months. And the 15 months, we did a lot. We went through and like reconed and all of our speakers and did stuff like that. I think we built this room during COVID, I believe. I mean, so we did a lot, but when we reopened, people weren't attending. They got in the habit of streaming at home. And, you know, God bless them, I did the same thing. But it bit hard. The cinema experience is it's half sound. So people who watch something on their laptop and they're like, oh, it wasn't a great movie. Well, if you sat in a theater with surround sound and a subwoofer that isn't designed to rattle your fillings out of your teeth, it makes the experience. And so it's difficult for us to be mad at people who don't want to come out. COVID taught us something, and that is that we can live without as much human interaction as we thought we did, as we needed. So coming to a theater and sharing an emotional experience about a film with your friends or people who aren't your friends, people became a little agoraphobic. They were antisocial because they were taught that's how they survived through COVID, is by staying the hell away from other people. So, yeah, we're suffering from that. That kind of rolled into it. And then the economy took a tumble. And the economy right now is in free fall. And this is why we sent out the letter, because it's like, you know, it's about to get real. And because of that, we need help or we're not going to be here. I was injured a while ago. And because of that, I can't work as hard as I used to. And because I'm still working, I'm not healing up like I should. So what I had to do was put a hard date of when I was done. So if things didn't improve and we weren't able to get in help, then I'm gone, so that I can go ahead and, you know, enjoy the rest of my life without being, you know, screwed up. We're trying to get something in order. So it's 2.5 years till I bail. And we have 2.5 years to come up with a plan and institute it before I'm gone. This is the hardest thing about this is that this place runs really well, where, you know, we have almost no margin. Well, we have no margin, but our staff knows this place backwards and forwards. They know their jobs. I very rarely have to come swooping in during an emergency because they know how to handle it. And half the time they don't even tell me because I don't need to know. And we have that built in. So there is so much yet so little we need to assure the perpetuation of the Dark Side Cinema.
We are joined by Paul Turner, co-owner of the Dark Side Cinema, who has recently sent out a letter to longtime patrons and the community expressing the economic reality. He can't go on forever. We all have finite life and life force to give to our passions. Let me ask you, Paul, what would be the ideal scenario for someone to come along and take over, or what do you envision as an ideal outcome?
Joey winning the lottery and taking it over. Meanwhile, back in the real world, because Joey doesn't buy lottery tickets, having someone who can come in as part of the community and partner with us, another business that can use the Dark Side as an augmentation to what they're doing so that they can support us during the gully that everyone falls into. So if we had someone who came in who had a complementary business and they wanted to be part of what shores this place up, that would be great. We've had a couple people talk to us about buying it outright, and that is a long, complicated conversation because I spent 30 years doing this, and I don't want to have it turn into something that is a departure from my vision and from the work that we have all done. There is a solution out there. The variety of responses and the number of people who want to hook us up with other people who want to hook us up with other people leads me to believe that there is a solution out there that's going to involve me being able to step back far enough to do what I need to do and for the people who are already here to move forward with what they already do so well.
Well, Paul, I really would like to thank you for your time today and thank you for providing this institution and helping make this city unique. We do need it.
I appreciate that. What you do is the same. You make the city unique. I had to do this because me getting a real job really wasn't going to happen. So I might as well build theaters and the community here. I mean, how many places in the world could I have gone and done this without being ridden out of town on a rail? So thank you to Corvallis. Thank you for taking the time to talk to me today.
And if listeners would like to get in touch with you, maybe with ideas, partnership, or beyond, how can they do that?
Paul@darksidecinema.com or go to our website, which is darksidecinema.com, and the email link there comes right to me.
And at the Dark Side Cinema page, you can also see current listings, learn a little bit more about this theater. However, I think your best bet is to come down to the theater and see it for yourself. It's indescribable, really, to compare to any other aesthetic that I've personally seen, and I'm really glad that this is a part of our community. Thanks again, Paul, for your time.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk about this.
And thank you to the manager, Joey, of 19 years of the Dark Side Cinema, for being here in the interview also.
Thank you. You're very welcome.
For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Dan Krall.